Thank you for downloading Analysis from the BBC. For over 40 years, Analysis has been examining the ideas and forces which shape public policy in Britain and abroad. I'm David Baker, and in this programme, as we mark the web's 25th birthday, we consider what we want from the web's next 25 years. Listen. This is the sound of the living, growing internet. It comes from a website called Listen to Wikipedia that translates everything that happens on the online encyclopedia into a musical note. A plucked string represents something being added by a user. A bell is something being deleted. The bigger the change, the lower the note. And whenever someone logs onto Wikipedia for the first time, there's a swell of strings. Wikipedia works on two basic principles that are at the foundation of everything that happens on the internet. First, it's open. Anyone can contribute anything. And second, it's equal. Every contribution has the same weight as every other. It's these two principles that have made the internet such a powerful force, full of new ideas that have already changed the world. Let's hear from two longtime champions of the internet. Jeff Jarvis teaches journalism at the City University of New York. He's excited about the profound potential of the web.
Oh, good God, we've seen incredible innovation on the web thus far, and it's just a hint of, I think, what could come. There's no predicting the future, of course, and there's lots of disruption to be had in my industry, in journalism, in yours, in broadcasting, in retail, in airlines, and you name the industry. It's been changed by the web so far. The web is open. Eric Schmidt at Google has talked about the fact that the founders of Google and Facebook and companies like that didn't have to ask permission. And the architecture of the web itself has an ethic behind it that says that all bits are created equal and that the ends are the most valuable part of it, not the center. That's a new structure for society where we tended to centralize things in large institutions. Now an individual user in one corner of the world has the same ability, once connected, to talk to the world as someone on the other side of the world, and that's very powerful.
Wendy Hall, professor of computer science at the University of Southampton and part of the newly formed Global Commission for Internet Governance, is equally enthusiastic about the web's openness.
That actually is why the web and the internet have grown so much, because they have provided a structure that it means anyone can set up a website and anyone can put content on the web, which is its huge strength, as well as some people might see a weakness, because there are no controls.
These principles have underpinned the World Wide Web since it was invented 25 years ago. But now they're under threat. You could almost take your pick of things that worry people about the web: pornography, bullying online, the stealing of copyrighted material. And instead of everyone's voice being heard, the internet today seems to be dominated by a handful of companies, Google, Facebook, Amazon, with enormous power. In this programme, I'll be asking what it is about the internet that makes it so innovative but so difficult to govern. It's actually no coincidence that the internet has these libertarian values at its core. It was invented, after all, in California, and Fred Turner, Associate Professor of Communication at Stanford University, says it's still showing its West Coast roots.
Dot-com work and computers are, in so many ways, placeless, right? They circle the globe. The internet is a global phenomenon. Yet the ideology we associate with those global technologies has a very deep local set of roots here in Silicon Valley. And that local set of roots goes straight down into the counterculture. California is 3,000 miles from New York, 3,000 miles from Boston, 3,000 miles from the East Coast. And it's always been a place in American culture where people go to try new ideas and to try new ways of living that might not yet have found a home or acceptance in other parts of the country. You may know that between 1966 and 1973, we saw the largest wave of commune building in all of American history. During that period, the people who were building those communes hoped to build communities of consciousness, communities oriented around a shared mindset, as an alternative to mainstream politics, and in many ways as an alternative to a kind of Eastern, East Coast, bureaucratic, top-down way of looking at the world.
This 60s counterculture carried on into the early days of the internet. One way it showed its face is in the Declaration of Independence of Cyberspace, a document published online, of course, and addressed to the governments of the world, by Grateful Dead lyricist John Perry Barlow.
We come from the internet, the new home of mind. We have no elected government, nor are we likely to have one. We declare the global social space we are building to be naturally independent of the tyrannies you seek to impose on us.
There's a clear overlap here between the technical possibilities of the internet and a political aspiration to create a society without rulers. Since Barlow made that declaration in 1996, the internet has penetrated almost every part of our lives. So how has that dream of self-governing liberty been realized in the technology world today? Fred Turner again.
Inside an engineering firm, there are very few folks advocating for constituencies that are not themselves represented in the firm. This was a problem on the communes as well. You know, communes got to be people who wanted to get together and share a mindset and who were fundamentally people like one another. And as a result, they tended to be extraordinarily homogenous. And if someone tried to bring in a more diverse crowd, you know, they wouldn't object to it on principle, but they might say, you know, man, that's just not cool. And I think there's something similar afoot now in the tech world. I think that it's very difficult from the spectacularly well-equipped campus of Google to imagine the necessity of serving folks who are impoverished, who are of color, who are in Detroit or New Orleans. That's a real challenge. I think that inside these firms, a notion of freedom that's predicated on problem-solving engineering leaves out folks who are not problem-solving engineers.
And according to John Norton, an academic at Cambridge who for a long time has been studying the internet and its effects on society, those early counterculturalists have now swapped their tie-dye for suits.
In the early days when cyberspace was a parallel universe to the real world, it was infected to some extent with counterculture. Some of it came from San Francisco and so on. But that's now a kind of a foundation myth rather than reality, because if you deal with any of the people who run these huge internet companies, basically what you find are hard-faced capitalists with a very good bedside manner. But my advice to the world is not to be taken in by the bedside manner.
It's a long journey from the counterculture to hard-nosed capitalism. So how did we get from the communes-based internet, with everyone on an even footing, to today's world, in which huge players seem to have all the money and power? Well, it seems that it was coming all along, because of the very nature of the internet itself. Wendy Hall worked with Tim Berners-Lee in the early days of the web.
Tim's philosophy about building the web was that either everybody was in it or nobody was. And it's a bit like the social networks or the search engines. You don't want to be in the social network no one else is in, right? You want to be in the social network where all your friends and peers are. And if you write a blog, you want potentially the whole world to read it. There's a return on your investment. It's hard to imagine it being any other form because you need all those connections to get your return on investment.
This phenomenon is called the network effect. It basically means that if something starts to get popular, we all want to be part of it too. Suppose you're throwing a party. All of your friends want to come and be part of it. But it'll only work if all the people taking part congregate together in one place. There's no point in having a party if all the guests go to different places. The more people come, the better the party. But the person who owns the place where the party's happening has a lot of power over what happens in it. They can choose the music, set the dress code, decide what time the party ends. It's the same online. We want to share our pictures and blogs, or advertise our goods and services. So it makes sense for us to put everything online in a place where everybody will see it. The more people who use this place online, the more it makes sense for us to use it too. This is the network effect. Take Facebook. There are, of course, other social networks, but can you think of them? In just 10 years, Facebook has gone from nothing to 1.2 billion users. That's almost the population of China. John Norton again.
Wherever you look in cyberspace, what you find is that a very small number of actors or agents or sites or companies or whatever have most of the action, and everybody else is in a long tail where there's not much happening. the phenomenon is the power, hitherto really unrecognized, I think, in most societies, of network effects. What it means is that essentially the value and power of a network increases exponentially as it grows. What that means in practice is that once you get this network effect going, then it makes it very difficult for other entrants to a marketplace to get a hold. And if you become a dominant player early enough, then your technical standards may become the de facto standard for an industry. Now, these are the affordances. You put them together and they all point in one direction, and that direction is monopolistic control.
We also, it turns out, made a key decision early on in the life of the web, which meant these big monopolies, the people who host the parties, became very powerful. Patricia Lewis is Research Director on International Security at Chatham House and co-director of the Global Commission on Internet Governance.
Many years ago, when people were first starting out in social media, there was a huge debate about whether or not this should be free at the point of access or whether people should pay as they go along, a sort of monthly subscription or whatever. The debate came out that it should be free at the point of access, but people understood then anyway that that meant more advertising. And that meant that their data was going to be harnessed and used, perhaps not in ways that we'd fully understood at that point, in order to tailor the advertising to make it more effective and harder to resist. That was the choice that was made. Now we're paying for that choice, it seems to me.
In what way are we paying for that choice now?
Well, I think we are aware that our data has been used in ways that we hadn't fully agreed to, and that that has also been abused by others where they've taken it and used it for other purposes that we had not agreed to at all.
The point is that if we weren't willing to pay for the services we got from social networks, online marketplaces and search engines as we used them, these businesses needed to find other ways of funding themselves. Jaron Lanier, the author of Who Owns the Internet, is an early internet pioneer who coined the phrase virtual reality. Since then, he's become something of a critic of the direction the internet has taken and regularly challenges the assumptions of the technology world. He spoke to me from California.
We were so concerned that it would become over-commercialized that we forced the commercial schemes that did occur to become more extreme than they might have been otherwise. So instead of just having people pay for stuff, we insisted it be free, which means the only way that the companies make money is with rather bizarre schemes where they are paid to micromanage the most available options in front of people, and that's what's called advertising now. So in a sense, we were so hostile to commerce that we forced commerce into a sort of a perverted state, and I think we really blew it.
One thing no one really realized in those early days is that by making the internet free, we were basically turning ourselves into commodities for advertisers. John Norton again.
We know from various studies that different internet users have different values. The most valuable internet user is a pregnant woman, because once she's pregnant, she's about to embark on a consumption pattern that lasts for a long time. And once you have a grip on that, once you know what she's doing, what the stuff she's likely to buy and the rest of it, then you're in business. That's the idea. She doesn't know that, perhaps. And there was an interesting study a while back by an American academic who became pregnant and decided she wanted to keep that information to herself. And the lengths that she, to which she had to go in order to ensure that internet marketers did not know that she was pregnant was really quite staggering.
Don't take it personally, but we really don't want to know everything about you.
Matt Britton, Google's vice president for Northern and Central Europe, thinks we shouldn't be so concerned.
What we want to do is try to help connect you with the information, the people and the ideas that you're looking for. And sometimes by telling us a little bit, we can do that for you better. But in every case, if we're asking you for more information, it's up to you to decide whether to give it to us. So, for example, if you're on Google Maps and you're constantly typing addresses that you're searching for, we might say, hey, you know, if you log into Google Maps, we can save those addresses for you. And also, if you search for something on your desktop and then pull out your mobile phone, we can show you the same thing. So it's a utility that improves if you decide to share information.
Jeff Jarvis agrees. By giving all this information to Google, we're simply helping them give us a better service.
What happens really is that I have a transaction with Google. I choose every day to let Google know where I am, because then I get relevance back in my search results. When I ask for pizza, I don't want a history of pizza. I want the nearest good pizza. When I ask for directions home, it's fine for me that Google knows where I live. Now, that's a transaction. I don't have to do this. I get benefit out of doing this. Look at it this way. Google does indeed know where I live and where I work, and as a result, it gives me incredibly relevant service in return.
So, we give up some of our privacy and get better pizza. Sounds reasonable. And to be honest, that's probably what all of us do pretty much every day. But is it really as simple as that? Jaron Lanier again.
To the ordinary person, it's a very bizarre moment because it looks like, oh, I don't know, it looks like a cheaper ride instead of a traditional taxi. It looks like a cheaper place to stay instead of a traditional hotel. It looks like free services. It looks like a weirdly easy loan to get sometimes. There's always these treats that are given in exchange for gathering more and more information. So in the short term, it actually looks great. But then in the longer term, what it does is it increases inequality in the society and it reduces the options for individuals because more and more jobs are taken over by the creation of more and more free treats or low-cost treats. So it's a very strange it's a very strange moment where giving up your rights, giving up your wealth, giving up your options in the long term happens in exchange for near-term treats. And it's very hard to tell somebody, you know, you're actually hurting yourself with a near-term treat, but that is what it's like. It actually feels good to fall into this hole.
And according to John Norton, that hole is going to be pretty deep.
The internet was designed as this amazing facility for communications between people, and it turns out also that it is the greatest surveillance machine ever invented. If you wanted a gloomy way of looking at this, I would say we have been sleepwalking into a nightmare of comprehensive surveillance. We are consoling ourselves with the thought, well, it's not so bad, we can live with it. We'll see.
This is the bind. The internet has given us all kinds of things that make life much easier. Email, calendars, documents we can share with anybody, anywhere, the ability to share photos and videos around the world. As we use these services, we give the people who provide them a huge amount of surprisingly detailed information about our lives. And because we don't want to pay for these services up front, the providers use this information to target adverts at us. So, what's the problem? Well, having all this information about us makes those providers extremely powerful. And some people are already deciding the situation needs to change.
Worth protecting. So what am I doing exactly? I'm deleting Facebook from my life, permanently. And you should too.
Recently, you made this video was posted last month by Matthias, an LA-based internet comedian. He uploaded it to YouTube, owned of course by Google, and it's already had more than 1 million views and thousands of positive comments.
What we do have is rights. Rights that people have died to give us. Forfeiting those rights for tailored ads or security is about the silliest thing you can do. If you give up your right to privacy to help...
The popularity of this video suggests he's onto something. But individual action probably won't be enough to stem the power of the net's big players. So where do we usually turn when companies are getting out of hand? Government and regulation. How does that idea go down with internet evangelist Jeff Jarvis?
God, no. For God's sakes, no. I marvel at the British reflex for regulation that you think it must be some natural state of being that we must step in and we must regulate. The web is already a magnificent invention, but we don't know what it is yet. Keep in mind that after Gutenberg invented the press, it took 50 years before the book took on its own form, 100 years before its impact on society was fully known. On that timeline, we're about the year 1470 in Gutenberg years, and we don't know what the net is yet. It is too soon to define it, thus limit it, and certainly too soon to regulate it and try to control it.
I completely disagree.
Fred Turner, who we heard earlier placing the roots of the internet in the values of the Californian counterculture.
I think those values have a particular impact on how we think about and how tech firms think about being regulated. You know, if you believe that freedom is a function of being independent together and collaborating in a low-key egalitarian way and being outside government, then the government itself looks like a dark force no matter which way you look at it. And my sense is that that might have been true in the 1960s during the Vietnam War for the new communalists who went back to the land and built those communes. But in our own time, that communal ideology that we should be apart from the government, building networks centered around communication technologies, is being leveraged, I think, quite tactically for firms to avoid being regulated by Washington and the East.
From within Google, the internet feels pretty heavily regulated already. After all, it's just had to make a major change in policy after the European Court of Justice ruled that people have a right to be forgotten on the internet. Google Vice President Matt Britton.
I don't think the internet's a Wild West. Everybody who's online is governed by the rules and the laws of every country in which those services are available. And they're different everywhere. And so there is a bit of a tension there between the opportunity to start a business. So how do you preserve the opportunity to do that whilst respecting legitimate differences in law and concerns that you have in different cultures and different countries around the world?
How do you do that?
Well, I think, you know, one of the challenges is it can be costly. I mean, just think about Europe. There are different data protection authorities in every country. And in some countries like Germany, they're different in every part of the country. So to comply with all of those things does have a cost. But, you know, of course, at Google, we work very hard to understand those laws, those regulations and those concerns and work with them.
If internet companies feel it's a struggle keeping up with the law also has a struggle keeping up with the internet. Gregor Pryor is a partner and digital media specialist at the law firm Reed Smith.
The law has been, in some instances, slow to catch up, and some instances has done pretty well at dealing with some of the vagaries of the internet, particularly territorially, although it's still far from perfect. And if you are a company operating on the internet, if you want to run a business on the internet, sometimes those local laws can still be a challenge and it doesn't quite fit. It's still a bit of a square peg in a round hole.
There's a dilemma here. On the one hand, we obviously don't want to suppress the amazing innovation of the internet. On the other, it does look as though we need to do something about the power of these big companies. And these digital companies sometimes seem to be borderless, as the taxman has discovered. So what about treating the internet as some sort of commons? Patricia Lewis again.
If you think about it as cyberspace, you can start thinking about it like the air or space or the sea. And it can be useful to think of it as a commons. We're all accessing it. It doesn't belong to anybody. We've all created it. But that's not different, in a sense, to creating a common piece of land, allowing it to go fallow, cutting the grass, allowing meadow flowers, etc., etc. So there are laws that we have that provide a framework for then developing what one might call rules of the road or codes of conduct.
Patricia Lewis's idea of the commons raises the possibility of some sort of international governance of the net. But it's not clear how much mileage there would be in this, considering how violently different governments disagree with each other. It's hard to imagine Sweden, the UK, Saudi Arabia, China and Russia all agreeing a common set of internet policies. Lawyer Gregor Pryor has his doubts about how a global legislature could work.
I don't think we're going to get to a place where you will have a centralised global government of the internet. It won't happen. What I think is unrealistic is to expect or imagine that the world's governments are going to get together and really agree on the way that the internet could be regulated. What I do think people are moving towards, and Sir Tim Berners-Lee and, you know, other pioneers are really interested in creating things like a Magna Carta for the internet, creating a set of rules that almost become self-adopted. And I could see some traction being gained there.
We heard Tim Berners-Lee's former colleague, Professor Wendy Hall, celebrating the openness of the internet. For her, how would a Magna Carta work?
When we talk about the Magna Carta for the internet, we talk about bringing the stakeholders together, and there are really three different groups: government, commerce, and us as citizens of the world. There's very few people that understand how all this fits together, and that's part of the issue, is that we've all got to get to the table and realise what one of those sectors do impacts on the others, and what are our rights and responsibilities within that troika.
A Magna Carta would be a set of rules of the road, devised and agreed on by the people who actually use the internet. Wendy Hall, along with other early internet pioneers, likes the idea because it seems to be in keeping with the self-governing principles at the foundation of the internet. But there are sceptics. John Norton.
I think the use of Magna Carta as a metaphor is almost always fatuous. Magna Carta was an agreement between a king and a whole group of barons. Okay, a Magna Carta for the internet would be, in that sense, would be a deal between governments and huge corporations.
What if we managed to widen it to governments, huge corporations and users?
I think the practical objection would be, how on earth would you incorporate the interests of 5 billion people? At the moment, 2 billion people, roughly a third of the planet, use the net. In 10 years' time, it'll probably be 5 billion. That's an unrealizable achievement.
Does that mean we're stuck with the world we've created?
If the technology is allowed to run rampant, as it has been, then we are going to have a world in which we always have these very big companies. Now, it doesn't have to be that way. The states could decide that there comes a point when these large outfits have to be brought to heel, or at least brought under democratic control. There is a slight problem with that now. States are compromised in their relations with these companies, because we now discover, for example, from the revelations of Edward Snowden, that the United States government, for example, relies heavily on the surveillance activities of the private companies. The sad truth is that both the NSA and GCHQ and all the other intelligence agencies across the world, including the Chinese, they are in the same business as Google and Facebook and co. They're all in the surveillance business. And in those circumstances, can we expect democratic societies to exert democratic control over these huge industrial interests?
There's no doubt that the internet, and especially the World Wide Web, has brought astonishing change to the world and improved the lives of those of us who are connected to it immeasurably. We use the internet extensively in the making of this program. And in fact, anyone could now make and broadcast a documentary like this from home. The democratization of the world that the early founders of the net envisaged has begun to arrive, and it's already delivering huge benefits. The question is, do we really understand how much we've handed over the future direction of the web to commerce? We've heard that John Norton thinks that politics is failing us here. He turns to literature for ways of thinking about where we're heading.
Our futures are bounded by the nightmares of two English writers, George Orwell, who feared that we would be destroyed by the things that we fear, and Aldous Huxley, who thought we'd be destroyed by the things that delight us. We thought we might get both. And that's what we have. We have Orwellian-scale state surveillance, and we have Orwellian-scale surveillance by companies who produce things we really like, whether it's the iPhone, cloud computing devices, or free email, or free social networking, whatever. We've got the whole lot in one package, and all in a single generation. It's kind of awe-inspiring thought.
Thanks for listening to this Analysis podcast. Next week on Analysis, Paul Johnson from the Institute for Fiscal Studies investigates why, despite recent economic growth, we're still earning less than before, and asks whether this is the end of the pay rise.